Welcome to The Ether. Today is Thursday, April 7th, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Glow Yield. Glow Yield is the ecosystem of Terra decentralized apps like Lotto and Creators, all powered by DeFi Yields. Glow Creators helps artists and influencers give their fans exclusive perks through membership, NFTs, and more. Glow Lotto is a PrizeLink savings account with a weekly chance to win the big jackpot. Tickets are free and perpetual, which means there's zero chance to lose money. Be sure to follow Glow Yield on Twitter and join the Discord community to stay up to date with all the glowing projects and check them out online at glowyield.com. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, the Regenerate News Hour. Let's take a listen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Regenerates. Just getting fired up here. Hold on just a second. I'm going to bring a few people up on stage. This is Dave Fortson. Stand by. Good morning, Rebecca. Good morning, Gregory. Oh, that says, there you go. You should be there as a co-host.
Hey, everybody. Hey, Dave.
Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Excited to be going live for another fantastically unscripted Regenerati News Hour. Where there's just so much going on that we don't even need to plan.
There's no shortage of things to talk about, Gregory. And where shall we start today?
Well, I mean, I think it's been fun to just start these news hours with a little bit of a, you know, personal update from the Maple Farm as folks are filing in. And then I think there's a number of different things on my mind. I'm particularly interested. I see Rebecca in the audience. I'm excited to, you know, maybe get some updates from her around grantees. I think there's we should probably do a quick section on the call about Nature Carbon Ton, and maybe pull some people in to talk bridges. We'll see if we can accomplish that. I think it's also worth probably having a quick look over the different forum posts that are live, where there's some pretty important conversations happening in the Regen Network world. So we might source some of our conversation about what's alive there. Those are a few things off the top of my head. I'm also going to be, as I oftentimes do, taking a quick moment to invite folks. So Twitter is such a following the serendipity of following the Twitter algorithm's recommendation for who I should invite into the room is also a pretty fun way to generate conversation topics.
Yeah, and actually just flagging too, I think I see Ben out there from the Gitcoin team. Hey, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
I see Sophia. Sophia, former R&D colleague, who's, I think, deep into biochar world out here on the West Coast with the UCSB Bryn School. There are going to be no shortage of things to dip into.
Let's start with Sophia. Sophia, I'd love to get you up. In order to talk about what's happening here on the Maple Farm, I would super love to dialogue with you a little bit. Sophia, if you're on your phone, specifically about biochar and some other things, I bet you have some ideas. Hey, Sophia, how are you doing?
Hey, all pretty good. I've been, like mentioned, I'm at the UCSB Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. So I've been kind of diving into to more of the things science related and especially related to carbon sequestration. And I've been doing a lot of research on biochar along with reforestation and the differences in carbon sequestration and cycling in tropical versus temperate ecosystems. But yeah, kind of to jump it off, to start it off, I've been really interested in biochar and how we can incorporate this in different farming practices, and also trying to understand the science behind what biochar is and how to incorporate it, and how to figure out how to integrate it into the costs and the benefits aligned with regenerative management, regenerative grazing, holistic management. So yeah, it's one of the topics I've been really interested on. And I think there's a lot of movement in the space and a lot of research being done on the topic.
Awesome, that's exciting. So kind of what's on top of my mind, I'm actually in my abundant spare time, I'm starting to work on an eco-credit class for regenerative maple production, since I'm living here on a beautiful maple farm at the southern edge of the Acadian bioregion here in the Berkshires of Western Mass. And some of the stuff that we're starting to work on here locally is just having a deeper understanding around both the forest carbon cycle of this northern hardwood forest and sort of optimal management, as well as the sort of life cycle carbon implications of the maple boil itself. Most maple producers these days use essentially diesel fuel, heating oil, as it's more commonly referred to around here, to run the furnace, to boil. Obviously, that's sort of a pretty big carbon footprint. Maple's actually quite a high carbon intensity product when it's done that way. And so we're starting kind of an arc of research around shifting to high efficiency pyrolysis for boiling, and starting to dig into understanding the sort of the optimal woodlot management for biomass, as well as maple, as well as biodiversity, to fuel those pyrolysis kilns, produce biochar as a byproduct, and cycle that back into the woodlot system. So that's just something I was actually, right before this call, I was deep into starting to map some things out on that front before shifting my attention here. So it was top of my mind. And, you know, Sophia, I'm interested in, I'm just interested in jamming just briefly about biochar, maybe at a high level, but also around, I don't know, like, who are you seeing out in the space? It's been a little while, actually, since I was really deep in the biochar world. Who are you seeing in the space that's doing really great work, both on the ecological and carbon cycle implications of working biochar into management mm-hmm. systems, as well as in the engineering, actually? Are you seeing people, and are you seeing departments that are kind of like really owning that holistic integration of biochar into how people are thinking about management?
Yeah, totally. I think especially, I believe there's a group at UC Davis, you know, they have a really wonderful agriculture department that is kind of focused on biochar and doing more of the intensive, more engineering said research on it. And just I'll also before diving into to people working on it, just a little background in the pyrolysis kind of process. For those who don't know, kind of the process to create biochar is you take these organic waste products and wood chips or agricultural byproducts or switchgrass coming from cover crop. And then you burn them at temps from ranging from, I think, around like 300 to 900 degrees Celsius. And you do it in a really low oxygen condition. And so that actually takes out around 50% of the biomass carbon that would have been otherwise released as CO2 through either decomposition of this biomass or through combustion. And then by placing it into the soil, it can actually increase the residence times of the carbon, because soil carbon is actually much more resistant to decay. And so that's kind of, to start off, that's the main driver to more research on the biochar side. But yeah, I think that the big kind of takeaway in terms of biochar is it has a huge impact also on soil functionality, because it really can help change the chemical composition and the surface chemistry related to the pore size within the soil, and also can really help with water retention. So those are just kind of a couple fun facts and a little bit background on biochar for those who might not be familiar. And in relation, yeah, I think UC Davis is doing a lot of great work, but I think there's a lot of, like you were saying, Gregory, a lot of independent land managers and farmers and owners who are doing, who are increasingly interested in this. I know there's been a lot more conversations around it. And since the science has been progressing so rapidly, I just think it's been pretty driven by demand and interest of people in the field who want to integrate this, not only for the carbon benefits, but also for improving, you know, the soil water retention, which also can increase yield. So that's kind of the other byproduct of biochar. It really can help improve the soil health and improve the overall yield. So yeah, I know some people within the region network science community are working on some of this research. Like I said, I think the main people I know working on this are at UC Davis. I don't know if there's anyone here at UCSB particularly working on biochar, but a lot of people in the soil health realm are looking at this as a different way to improve soil health overall. So yeah.
Just a shout out. Also, if anybody is interested, less on the engineering side and more on the, less on the science side and more on the engineering side around how to build sort of modular farm scale biochar kiln systems to sort of integrate into these regenerative agroecological systems, ping me. Because as Sophia is saying, the science on this is rapidly progressing. I think the engineering is as well, although I think, as always, a lot of attention is being put on sort of like large scale systems. And, you know, groups like All Power Labs, and there's a couple of others that I'm aware of, there are people who are working on these sort of like more modular, smaller scale systems that are maybe more appropriate for a small smallholder, a small farmer. But I'm personally particularly interested in that edge, because I think for our case on the maple farm, especially if we're going to integrate this as a method for boiling sap and making syrup in a way that's integrated into sort of a healthy interaction with the carbon cycle, where we're able to source the biomass that's the fuel for the boil from our woodlot management program, it's going to have to be scaled to the scale of our mapling operation, right? And that's going to be the case in all of New England and the larger sort of eastern woodland, where these sorts of woodlot management systems are integrated with mapling or other use cases where you may want some heat and you may want to do it in a way that isn't just pulling petroleum. So anyway, I'm super interested. And as always, you know, it's sort of like this intersection between the science, you know, how do we monitor and measure the outcome and really know, both from a decision-making standpoint, if we're having the impact on soil health and healthy carbon cycle that we want, as well as the engineering side, where we're actually kind of, you know, retooling our agricultural systems in order to generate these outcomes. It's fun to be, because it takes so many different community members to make this work. Rebecca, you raised your hand to hop up. Do you have anything to throw in here?
I feel like I always have something to throw in on biochar. What's up, Sophia? Love hearing about your work. Love knowing that more work is being done. When I was in grad school about 6 years ago, biochar was the hot topic, and my awfully curmudgeon senior scientist advisor would say that it's nothing new. In so many ways, like the product has been made for a long time by lots of indigenous communities in the world. And I like to always frame it as not something new that we've discovered, but something that we're trying to figure out more about scientifically and applied in the field. And I feel like whenever I've made my own biochar and applied it in my own growing, it's been such an interesting experiment in like what impact it has. And thinking about, you know, we have Kolshan Carbon Trust, who's on here, an R&D community fund grantee who's doing a biochar pilot project up in the northwestern United States. And we really think about like the moment that we're in now is, what does the application look like? How do you source it? How do you deal with emissions from biochar production? Where is it, you know, good to apply? Where is it potentially negative to apply it? How do you apply it? You know, what machinery or equipment is used at what scale? I feel like we're definitely at the use case moment. And I'm really excited to see, like, Sophia, your research. I'm super excited to see what Kolshan does with their work. I just always like to frame it as it's new and old all at the same time. And I feel like if Kolshan is in the audience, it'd be great to have them share where they're at. And I feel like it would be cool to jam even between like Sophia and them around what they find interesting to explore and like what the needs are in terms of like developing approaches to track it. Is Kolshan in the group?
Kolshan, if you're out there, just raise your hand if you're not using the Kolshan handle, which I don't see that the Kolshan handles out there. But Holler, you can always just raise your hand and I'll grab you. Otherwise, though, I think we should carry on.
Yeah, cool. Well, so let's see. There's a couple. I'm just sort of scanning the audience right now. And thinking of some of the living conversations that the community is having right now, in addition to this interesting one. And I'm actually kind of looking forward. This is a pretty wild topical shift from, you know, integration of biochar into ag and other land use systems and the science behind that over to quadratic funding. I'm wondering, Ben, from the Gitcoin team, if we could invite you up to chat with us a little bit, because there's about to be this. Well, so broadly speaking, I kind of want to do a large overview of funding public goods and sort of some of the living conversations that are happening on the Region Network Forum right now around this sort of as a broad topic. And then I kind of want to move that from a broad topic into what's going to be happening at Gitcoin grants round 14. Hey, Ben, welcome.
Thanks so much. Hey, everybody. Nice to be with you this morning.
Do you want to just give a quick intro to yourself and maybe to Gitcoin and, you know, where Gitcoin and Region have been partnering? And then maybe I can explain to folks some of the reasons why I'm so excited about what Gitcoin is doing and where it sort of fits in with some of the live conversations that are happening inside of the Region community. And then after that, we can maybe do a little bit of a overview of Grants Round 14, when it's happening and what's exciting about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So just a quick kind of background on me. I currently run the cause rounds for Gitcoin. Particular focus on the climate round. My background is I've spent the better part of the last 20 some odd years working in environmental NGOs on a variety of topics, but primarily on forestry, agriculture, and climate, as well as some urban planning stuff. I'm, you know, very excited about everything that's happening in the regen space, and I'm like super thrilled to be in a position to try to help, you know, move the cutting edge of, you know, what we can do with Web3 and crypto to, you know, help push forward the kind of solutions that we need in the world. And, you know, in terms of what's happened up until this point with GR12 and GR13, there was the first two set of climate cause rounds. The first one had about 20 participants. And the second, we had over 90 and folks represented from all across the globe, which is quite exciting. And, you know, as we're moving forward, you know, it's been great that Regen Network's been a partner in, you know, both of those rounds and has really helped to bring a bunch of amazing projects to the fold, as well as funding to, you know, for the round itself. We had close to $500,000 in matching funds in the last Climate Cause round, which actually made it the biggest round besides the Support for Ukraine round and the main round. You know, so Gitcoin is now moving further and further down the road of, you know, really trying to decentralize elements of how the round is working. We're setting up an advisory council that I've been talking to Gregory and others about that, you know, I think is going to be really important to sort of setting the structure of what future rounds look like and really just creating more opportunities for people to get involved in, you know, some of the decision making around sort of what qualifies for rounds and how funds are distributed and all kinds of interesting stuff, all sort of as Gitcoin is moving towards this idea of Grants 2.0, which is like a fully decentralized grants platform that basically gives, you know, anybody who wants to run their own quadratic funding round the opportunity to do so. Not sure how familiar everybody is with quadratic funding. I'm happy to sort of try to do a quick TLDR explainer about that if you think that would be useful. But
I think that'd be great. I think a quick sort of like get quadratic funding overview, and just shout out there was a recent Green Pill podcast with Kevin Iwaki and Glenn Weil, which also is a really awesome sort of overview of the inception and the current, so like how quadratic funding is currently working. But Ben, if you could give us a quick overview of that, that'd be fantastic.
Cool. Yeah, and I'll definitely plus one to that being a great podcast to check out. That particular episode I thought had all kinds of juicy and interesting tidbits in it about what's good and what could be better about quadratic funding. But I mean, the way that I generally explain it to people is that it's a lot like doing a peer-to-peer fundraising campaign from the grantee's perspective, you know, very much like a GoFundMe or a Kickstarter campaign. But really what makes it special and different is that there's this pool of matching funds that partners put in dedicated to different ecosystem or cause rounds. And when I say ecosystem, I you know, in terms of like sort of Web3 ecosystems, like, for example, ENS or Uniswap or you know, Polygon, these different, you know, sort of sub-communities in Web3 have their own ecosystem rounds, quote unquote. And, you know, that matching pool is distributed not on a one-to-one dollar-for-dollar basis, but based on a mixture of the number of people supporting a particular project or a particular proposal and the amount of money that's been raised. So it's kind of somewhere between $1, one vote, and one person, one vote. It, you know, is basically a mechanism for distributing matching funds in a way that's much more distributed, much more democratic, and gives opportunity to a lot of projects that may struggle to find funding in other more traditional ways. You know, as somebody who's worked in environmental nonprofits most of my life, I find it to be a very refreshing change from more traditional grant funding processes, which, you know, sometimes can have very onerous, you know, sort of proposal requirements, and also can be a bit of a black box in terms of, you know, really knowing how those funds are being allocated and sort of what you need to do to be successful. You know, really it's a way of sort of testing the buy-in and support for ideas, often relatively early stage, you know, from the community, and also just a way to, you know, increase the participation of community members in, you know, directly getting involved in funding projects that they support and that they like. The interesting thing that we've also seen happening, you know, especially in the last round as the number of projects grew, as we've seen an increasing, you know, sort of cross-pollination between, you know, projects that are either in similar spaces and may not have met each other yet, or even folks who are in like totally unrelated fields, but sort of get to know each other through the process of, you know, promoting their grants and, you know, sort of joining others in collections of grants that they're kind of cross promoting together, which has been an interesting sort of evolution in how the platform is being used. But really at its core, it's the quadratic funding mechanism is a way to to basically help Gitcoin and partners distribute the funds that that we have available as matching funds. And, you know, it can often result as a donor in like you put in, $1, one DAI, one whatever token you're using to support. And that could be matched, 10x or 100x, depending on sort of where that particular project is, in the process. The exciting news that's, coming down the pipe, maybe giving people a little bit of alpha here, is that an integration with Cosmos has just, I think gotten to the point where we're pretty close to being ready to start talking about it with everybody. It's been sort of a long time coming, and it looks like we're going to be able to, actually accept donations in Atom in the upcoming GR14 cause round.
Yeah, which is super exciting. So just to kind of like step back and distill some of this, so and maybe contextualize why we've been particularly excited about quadratic funding and how it fits in. So quadratic funding is a mechanism where there's a matching pool that is distributed according to the number of sort of dollar votes. Individual dollar votes, not the quantity of dollars. So it's matching. It's like a democratic fund matching mechanism. So if you had 100 matching, if you have a pool of 100 matching dollars, and one person donated $100, the match would be much less than if 100 people matched donated $1. Just to wrap people's head around the basic mechanism. And some of the stuff that we've been working on at Regen Network includes our longtime partnership with Open Team, which is an open source software and science, network, essentially, that includes farmers and some leading research institutions and actually big. Big ag companies. I have interacted in Open Team with everybody from John Deere and General Mills to, really small hobbyist, farmers, essentially. So there's a big group of people building an open source community. And that community is actively working through how to fund open source software development, open source hardware development, open source science, to sort of have a common basis of tooling that's pre-competitive, open, and available, everything for everybody to access for decision-making support, monitoring, ecological outcomes, ecosystem service marketplaces. So Regen Network has been contributing and engaging, helping fund and receiving funding in the Open Team network for more than 3 years now. And one of the exciting early use cases, we actually used a simple quadratic funding mechanism after some interaction with Gitcoin, actually 2 years ago now, I think, in which we just did some experiments to see how quadratic funding could support this sort of like non-crypto community, really, although we've been working to integrate distributed ledger technology and some of the sort of like data and governance backbone tools that we're building at Regen Network into that community, obviously. But, it isn't a community of sort of Web3 native crypto people. It's a community of academics and farmers, essentially. Experimenting with this quadratic funding led that community to desire to start managing the distribution of their USDA matching funds to projects using the quadratic funding. And I think we got to rename quadratic funding, Ben. I think it's a horrible name, just to be honest. I was thinking about
that.
It's so geeky, and it's community funding or like the community match fund process. I don't know. We'll gotta, maybe somebody in the audience has an idea here, but the amazing thing, just to sort of like recenter that, one of the things we're all in on this as one of the mechanisms. I don't think it's the only one, but it is an important way to discover what a community needs by allowing them to signal that with matching fund to access matching funding by donating their own money to things that they think are essential, right? And it's just a really elegant mechanism. Again, I don't think it's the only one, but I'm getting quite excited about integrating a quadratic funding module onto Region Ledger so that our community can use that to participate in future grant rounds for funding the development of new eco credits, for funding things that the community would like to source. And we already have this community pool. You know, like Regen as a community already governs, I don't know, $4 or $5 million worth of Regen right now at this moment that could be getting matched through community processes, just in a very similar way as Gitcoin is running. As one of, and I don't think it should really be the only mechanism for how we're distributing funding for research and development and kind of community engagement, but I think it's a really important one because you can sort of envision there start to be Regen rounds related to methodology development, related to applications, related to maybe just like supporting land stewards in sort of a fellowship program. So anyway, it's pretty exciting, and I know there's several community members working on this. There's been some forum conversations, particularly the Cambium validator. Back in the day, they wrote a smart sort of a Regen compatible smart contract for quadratic funding. That was a couple of years ago. It needs to be upgraded and tested, but there's sort of this prior art and this opportunity to continue to experiment with this. And the next phase of that experimentation, as Ben was just noting, Gitcoin is going to be integrating the ability for atoms as sort of the IBC, interblockchain and Cosmos communities' most liquid asset and money into Gitcoin round 14. Right. And so as a community, I'm pretty excited for Regenerates, Regenerati, Regens, for those of us who are engaged with development of ecologically regenerative digital assets to engage with this Gitcoin round, because there's going to be a climate round. There's also going to be a Cosmos round, which allows, I'm also super excited at wearing my sort of Cosmos ecosystem, Cosmos maxi hat, for us to be engaging in funding things that we all need through this mechanism. And kind of particularly excited to see Gitcoin broadening out beyond just the Ethereum audience. These are all reasons why I'm pretty excited about what's happening and what's moving here. Sophia, do you want to add on to anything?
Yeah, I was just going to riff off that really quickly, kind of from the science side. I know you touched on a lot of the development, how this can support methodology development. But also, I think because there's so many different lanes that people are trying to run in to develop different types of eco credits, this type of funding structure could really incentivize the development of a wide diversity of credit types, right? It really opens the door to looking at things, you know, beyond carbon. We often talk at Region Network, right? Like, how do we look beyond carbon and we look towards these other indicators? And so I think this funding structure really allows to open that door and kind of broaden the scope of what we're doing and allows people like me on more of the science side to really have the opportunity to take time and have those resources to look at some of these other things. So I just wanted to throw that out there because I think it's a fantastic structure and it really, really supports the overall R&D and research and furthering just the knowledge base of all these things.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. And thanks, Ben, for sharing a little bit about that. Taking another little step beyond sort of quadratic funding, I also want to share a couple of interesting things that are starting to become possible in the Cosmos ecosystem over the next couple of months, just related to allocation, things like the ability to allocate staking rewards. LP rewards, the opportunity to shift to sort of a continuous funding model where we can, as a community, identify projects or people that need that we want to support because they're doing essential bits of work. There's a bunch of work happening right now to make that really quick and easy to essentially be able to say, you know, hey, you know, I see Timo in the audience out there, like, hey, there's the Basin DAO address. They're developing, you know, eco credits from these bits of property. I want to just, you know, allocate funding from my current, you know, region staking position so that they can, you know, be working on that. Or, oh, hey, Sophia and her team are working on an eco credit class around biochar. I want to just start channeling some resources there. Those tools, I think, are really important, really necessary, and starting to become more and more possible. So there's this, there's a module that started out being called, I think it's called the fee tip module or something, that is actually going live on the Cosmos Hub. So it does a significant amount of work here. And then there's another, this is sort of like on the geeky sort of like code side of things. There's also a really fantastic bit of work that Joshua, a community member, a region community member, did at the Hackatom this autumn in Lisbon, called the Allocation Engine, which does just that, which allows you to sort of be allocating from one address to another the continuous rewards. So this is a different mechanism than having sort of like a quadratic round where there's a matching pool and people go through a process and there's voting and then that matching pool is allocated out. This is a different sort of continuous funding mechanism. And one of the things I'm most excited about is having several of these different funding mechanisms. You know, right now, all we have in Region Network as a funding mechanism is just sort of the unicameral, all token holders can vote to allocate assets to something, right? But I actually think we need to be a little bit more agile. I think that's pretty scary. There's a whole process to get, you know, the governance vote together, and maybe some people will like it and some people won't. But I think the more different ways we have of allocating resources and funding independent initiatives that are sort of expressing a creative way of engaging with issues, the more that we're going to sort of see a virtuous cycle of funding, innovation, and engagement. So yeah, just super excited to see more innovation on this front. And for those of you who haven't, there's also, you know, sort of circling back to like, where are we now? Because we've been talking about, you know, so we there was just an amazing climate round on Gitcoin. Many Regen community members participated. Awesome. There's going to be another one coming up in June. Awesome. That's going to be a really fantastic way to engage. And of course, people right now can bring to governance, if you have an important bit of research or development that is going to build the health or help accomplish the mission of Region Network, you can bring that to the community, right? And there are funds to access. And then, you know, so we're sort of future casting some of the innovations that I think are going to make it quicker and more effective for us to make smaller funding decisions more often instead of big funding decisions. So just to sort of like contextualize that fully. All right. So, yeah, I'm curious if any of the other guests have, you know, Rebecca, Sophia, Ben, David, any of you have final thoughts on that topic?
I'd love to give some space. We've got Steve from Colchin Carbon Trust in the room, and I'd love to have him come up and share, because I feel like they're a really great example of not just like applied science and working on biochar, but how they're a group that's trying to explore what different funding opportunities there are. So I'd love to give them some room.
Awesome. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, how are y'all?
Doing great. Great. Yeah, how are you?
Good.
How are you this morning?
Good. Is Howard on with us?
I'm waiting to see him pop up.
Okay.
You keep it on going.
Well, I'll get started. And I'm with the Colchin Carbon Trust, and we're what we call a carbon conservation trust. And part of this whole concept of carbon conservation that we've been writing about, in, you'll see a paper about a carbon conservation trust movement at Medium. under our names. But as part of that, we started the Kulshan Trust, and then we connected you all with you all around this idea of getting a methodology finished and usable for biochar, right? So we're doing this biochar project, and we live in the Pacific Northwest, and we're on the west side. So it's a very wet and a very productive sort of Doug fir, hemlock, cedar, big leaf maple kind of ecosystem, and then a lot of ag land. And in our area, that ag land is primarily berries, right? So in this project, what we've done is we've connected with Vera and their methodology around biochar that they're moving along through the approval process. And if you're all familiar with that Vera methodology, there are really three phases of it, right? So there is the waste biomass sourcing stage, and you all talked about feedstocks a little bit before. There's the production stage, and there's the application stage. And each one of those could have multiple different ways you go, resulting in much different supply chains, right, and the flow of these materials. So for instance, on the waste biomass side, it could be agricultural waste biomass, forestry and wood processing, the whole recycling economy, including construction and demolition waste, aquaculture, and animal manure, right? What we've decided to do is focus on egg waste, which in our egg waste product we're looking at to start with is bamboo, which is grown in the ag community here. On the forestry side, we're focusing on commercial forest residuals, slash piles, essentially, and dug fir forests. And on the recycling economy side, we're focusing on clean construction waste, that basically the ends from a whole wood that now are going in the landfill. For the other two sources, it's all being burned on site in most cases. So our whole idea here is, instead of burning this stuff up, can we make biochar out of it? Then in the production phase, what Vera does is they have a high-tech approach to pyrolysis and a low-tech approach. And what we're doing is we're starting with a low-tech approach, which basically is conservation burns in the woods using very little minimal technology and very little change to the practices of these operators now, right? But in the net later on, what we want to do is we want to move into the high-tech burns. And to qualify as a high-tech burn, you got to capture 70% or more of the off-gases, or you have to do cogeneration. You got to use that excess heat to produce electricity, which then can be an offset, right? And then on the application stage, there are two various ways to go. One is an ag application, and the other one is to use the biochar material and mix it with the built environment materials we use. So for instance, concrete and asphalt, and mixing it into those kinds of materials. And we're focusing on soil, and we're looking at making compost and mixing it with the biochar, because if you don't, the biochar actually is a sponge which can leach nutrients from the soil. So we're sort of almost like supercharging it with these nutrients through composting before it's used in the soil. So that's the basic process we're going through. You know, this could be quite complex if you had three different biomass sources, three different production stage burning techniques, and three different applications. That would be 27 different trials, say, and with that is just too much. So we're limiting it to three biomass sources, one a low-tech burn, and one end application. And we can look at doing more of that kind of thing later.
Awesome. Thanks for walking us through that, Steve.
Yeah.
Sophia, Rebecca, do you have any questions or comments that you want to throw in here after getting kind of that overview from Steve?
I feel like the other dimension to this that I would love to bring to the table is the simple like land trust idea, because that's a component of your work, Stephen. And I know sure. Howard is out there listening and hopping on, and how we often talk about how the bioregional realities and organizations and you know, on the ground meets with the digital, and
right.
Thinking about how like the idea of the land trust is brought into like the Web3 world and the opportunities they're in, and wondering if you or anyone else has thoughts on that.
Well, I can talk a little bit, and Howard, just interrupt if you're on and want to take it away. But so the basic idea here is we're looking at carbon, whether currently sequestered or the potential to be sequestered, as ecosystem service, just like any other ecosystem service, open space, biodiversity, those kinds of things. And instead of looking at something as it's something negative that we have to regulate, it's something we want to conserve and preserve. Right? So we look to this idea of the land trust and how they are operating in an environment where we don't have the political consensus to exercise the police powers of the state to regulate, or the taxation powers of the state to get us to the climate place we need to be. But what other tools can we do? And what the land trust community has done since the 1950s, is they've used the power of durable contracts, which are called conservation easements, and markets to basically acquire these ecosystem service values, right? And we thought, why not apply those same things to carbon? So we know how to do, say, we know how to make biochar, and in the day is going to come soon when we can monetize that and create these credits. We're getting close right now. But what we don't have are these agreements or these processes with these carbon asset holders to incentivize them to get into the work and start doing it. So that with the idea of these durable contracts, what we call carbon easements, and using markets to acquire and sell those carbon rights, that's how we want to kind of move the ball down the road.
It's so exciting. I love the concept of carbon trust and creating durable. I mean, I think really understanding that a longevity of long contracts,
right,
are really essential for the shifts in economics and land use that we need to undergo as a society in order to be more coherent with the carbon cycle. You know, it's just, so it's really exciting the work that you all are doing. And Steve, do you want to speak a little bit about, I mean, my understanding is there's a pretty, there's quite a bit of depth to the, sort of many years of legal research and acumen that's kind of getting poured into how Kolshan is approaching this. Do you want to talk a little bit about the backstory there?
Well, Howard, you'd be perfect for this if you got your mic working.
If he's on his computer, I don't see him. I don't see him up as a speaker. If he's on his computer, he won't be able to hop up. Twitter only is available. Twitter Spaces is only available for phone. You know, for the phone app. Yeah.
He's working on that, and so I'll just start while he's there. So you're exactly right. So for 70 years. There's been legal work done on these ideas of these durable agreements that we call conservation easements. And if you think about it, you can protect a lot of things. It can be open space by basically acquiring the subdivision rights to a piece of property. You can acquire the rights to extract minerals from it. You can acquire the water rights to keep it watered and keep say wetland systems intact. And you can acquire the carbon. Right. So but what we do, and so there's been years of working this out through legal enabling legislation in every state of the country to do this kind of work. But what hasn't happened yet is the adding of carbon into the mix as a conservation value that's recognized by this enabling legislation at the 50 state level and by the IRS, in order that these carbon asset holders, if they donate those carbon assets, that they get a tax deductible donation for it. So yes, I'd say there's this great legal foundation there around these durable agreements that really do result in additionality and avoided conversion. But what we've not done in the legal work we need to do in the case law work is around establishing carbon as one of those values.
Awesome. I love it. I'm going to bring Sev up.
As a potential segue or follow up, I feel like this ties into a really big idea that we have also always tossing around is the idea of land itself being the identity. It's something that Austin, like we've talked about, and how if we're tracking, you know, changes in a landscape over time, like tracking that by land instead of by just steward alone, that like the steward is one piece in many generations of effort to regenerate a landscape. And so we end up turning the focus to the land itself. And I feel like the land trust is already an example of how to do that, this passing along. And I feel like we could mimic a lot of the value of that in how we approach and organize ourselves.
Love it. Super cool. And Timo's wanting to hop up here. Have you up in just a moment, Timo. Sev, do you have anything to throw in on this topic?
I do. So my co-founder, Nathaniel Stern, he's a professor and academic and artist, and he's worked directly with a soil scientist, Johannes Lehmann. And he is a soil scientist at Cornell, who I believe is kind of a leading voice on pyrolysis and biochar and doing a lot of research there. So just want to make this connection. There might be, I kind of heard there was, I didn't quite grasp it completely, but that there's some kind of experimentation going on in terms of testing the different forms of pyrolysis and what that looks like. So I'm sure there could possibly be some collaboration there on experiments because that's what he does full time, and we have that connection. So just want to put that out there.
Super. That's great.
Awesome. Thanks, Sev. Timo, what's up?
Hey, everybody. Great to see some familiar faces. I just wanted to weigh in on the conservation easement part. You know, my, previous career has been 20 years doing basically leasing and investment sales of commercial investment real estate with leases, and the value is in the leases. So I think conservation easements are a great way to do all this, and especially permanent, perpetual ones, like Steve is talking about. I think donations of those different assets in the conservation easements are a great approach. But one thing I've been personally working on for many years, and it's going to be a big part of the basin thesis, is the climate lease or climate.lease. And it's a way to tie up property basically for all these regenerative uses and needs for up to 100 years. And in doing so, if we structure the deals right, we can mobilize indifferent and agnostic capital to do that. So money that doesn't care about climate, carbon, nature, it just cares about a durable return from real estate. And I just wanted to bring that to the forefront, because a permanent conservation easement is great, but I think we need flexibility, especially in the eyes of like the 2050 goal, for example. Like, what if we need different land uses, you know, 30 years from now, like, and everything's permanent? I mean, you know, I know everything's not going to be permanently conserved, but like the idea of building in flexibility in leases do that. If entities and groups and land trusts lease property and tie it up like a conservation easement per se, but it brings in the flexibility to do that. And if the deal is structured right, investors will be all over that. And I just, if anyone wants to talk about that, that's a big part of my jam. So,
well, this is Stephen. I would just comment on for a minute is that I think that's really exciting. And it sort of makes the point that these agreements can be on a spectrum, right? From all the way from in perpetuity to a very short term of time, and from something that rides with the deed to something that's more like a contractual lease, right? And every situation is going to be different. So if we get the entities in place who are going out and doing this work with these carbon asset holders, they can use the right tool for the right person for the right kind of carbon asset that needs to be conserved.
Yeah, 100%. I think we just need to use all the different tools.
That's right.
Toolbox to do that.
Yep.
Awesome. Thanks, Timo. Austin was up here. Did he hop back on? off? Did they hop back off? Austin looks like hopped. Okay. I was interested to hear Austin speak about the work that Region Foundation is doing specifically on kind of this intersection of rights of nature and corporate personhood for landscapes and how that's intersecting with these durable land trusts as well. But it looks like Austin had to hop maybe. Rebecca, that's what you were thinking of in relationship to Austin as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if we're thinking about how you said, Gregory, like allowing 1,000 flowers to bloom, we're going to really have to reimagine this scaling, not just in number of people participating on, you know, what we're trying to build, but on the scale of time forward, and how we map and connect people and then build, you know, when we're thinking about permanence and carbon and soil, and really even linking back to thinking about biochar as the more stable form of carbon, like all of that is tied to the land itself, not solely the stewards that are on it. And I think it really reflects a lot of the conversations that we've had with Region Foundation, where we're talking about Indigenous communities that that really that have that core to their, you know, to their organizational structures and then to their relationship with nature. And I think there's a lot to be learned and a lot that we can integrate in our approach. I think all ideas are on the table, you know, when it comes to how we meet these needs and innovate at the moment. And that's very much from like the registry mindset that I'm holding now. But certainly when we think about, you know, R&D as building platforms and tools to meet those needs, it all is very much a woven conversation.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And maybe as we're moving towards wrapping, we can kind of just take a step back. And I think it's probably useful for all of us to think about, I mean, at least what's on my mind at the end of this conversation is just this intersection of, I guess, what an agreement is between different people, one another, you know, as humans, and a landscape, and how we're representing those agreements. And for a long time, I remember, you know, I would be pitching Region Network to folks, and I'd say, it's a platform for agreements about ecological state. And people would say, you know, WTF, what are you talking about? What does that even mean? But at this really abstract level, right, what are we doing? You know, what we're doing is we're making agreements between each other that are durable. They last for an appropriate period of time in order to steward landscapes. And those agreements are translated into our economics, into our social norms, you know, and what Region Network is doing is trying to create sort of a quick, transparent, you know, quick and easy, inexpensive way to enter into pretty complex agreements between people, right? And to bring the value that those agreements produce, which is ecological health, into, you know, into existence, right? At a foundational level, that's what this is all about. And that's what Region Registry is doing, you know, sort of creating the composable set of agreements about how we're measuring things, how we're quantifying things, how we determine value, how we link that outcomes to the people responsible, the stewards who are responsible for generating those ecological outcomes. That's what this is all about, you know. And I think we tend to get easily sort of carbon tunnel vision, right? Because that's the most obvious in many ways, I guess, value that ecological stewardship can generate for the current moment that we live in, where people are increasingly aware of global warming, climate instability, atmospheric carbon accumulation. So we can say, oh, the carbon cycle, that's where we need to sort of transform and optimize for a healthy carbon cycle and carbon sequestration. But the way in which that happens is this sort of transparent, community-owned infrastructure for people making agreements between each other about ecological health, and making that transparent, composable, and inexpensive to accomplish, right? And I think that's the commonality that's being expressed on this call, is really different approaches that are all converging, you know, from land trusts and conservation easements to, you know, contracts and real estate to science related to monitoring and quantifying soil health and biochar. You know, how do we verify all this? All of this is pointing at the same fundamental process of agreeing with one another about ecological health outcomes we'd like to accomplish together, and, you know, making sure that everybody's supported to accomplish that. So, yeah. We're at the top of the hour, folks. So thanks so much for coming to another Regenerati News Hour. And this has been a super fun, continues to be a super fun experiment in just sort of starting these shows up and engaging in these dynamic conversations and seeing what moves. I think we're going to continue to sort of, yeah, try to hold this as an unscripted weekly space for community members to gather and dialogue and converse about just this living edge of regeneration that we're all working on together. So thanks again for joining, everyone. And we'll see you next week, if not before. So with that, yeah, have a beautiful, beautiful day.
Have a good day, everybody.
Bye.
Yeah.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was the Regenerati News Hour, recorded on Thursday, April 7th, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the lunatic community. Visit OC's What We Do page using the link in the show notes to take advantage of some of their other educational resources, including weekly meetups to discuss Terra protocols, strategies, and concepts, the Terra Luna Intel Report on Telegram, and YouTube explainer videos on Terra concepts. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. This episode of The Ether was also brought to you by Luart. Luart is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. Luart provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. Watching these debates, like, what a bunch of noise. When the illusion of choice outmaneuvers your voices, no one really knows what the fuck is going on here. Sitting in the bunker, waiting for the all clear. It's like we're getting steered towards the motherfucking iceberg. Captain all drunk, deciphering where the ice lurks. And we thought 2020 was gonna be a nice year. Living with the plague, like, who brought the mice here? Try to think of it as another simulation. Game full of bugs, but it's still fun to play. It's like we're aliens, beta testing Earth. Digging in the dirt, trying to earn a little girth. The beast is silent when it defeats the riders. Living outside, trying to meet this virus. If you wanna watch it all burn from the sky rise, delete the science and increase the righteous. Living like a jerk, return to feed the worms. Vibing like a tree, just breathing out the words. Be careful outside, them police is violent. Feeling like I finally earned some peace and quiet.
Nice time.
Little piece of pie first, trying to be the fat kid you least admire. Feast of fire when the beasts of burden are getting all bored, but at least we're certain we found the imposter living among us, fussing with hunches. Another big chungus bludgeon. Don't worry, the fungus will clean up the guts and get us to function on fleeting assumptions. I see through the rust from rush to rush. Shower stacked up like a bunch of junk. So hush your muff before we stuff your luck and break your fucking neck to this like bust a bust, bleeding impulsive, the meeting controls it when breathing corrosive, no eating the bullshit, feeling the worth like it's gonna be a good year, now we're all tired, stop treading on the work here. Nice time.
Is the best.